Radio.
Opening Our Eyes to Injustice, a talk by Dr. Robert Tilley at the Faith in Action Expo.
One of the things I want to start off with is actually something very appropriate for what's happened this week, and that's Pope Francis's first official document, the Apostolic Exhortation, the Evangelii Gaudium. That apostolic exhortation says, if it says one thing, that apostolic exhortation of Pope Francis says this: we can change the world. We can change the world. It is a call for a joyous evangelism by reason that although so many people today, I guess probably like many of us who are over the age of 40, I think for many of us, we think that people, that we despair a little bit, that things are cast in stone. But what Pope Francis's apostolic exhortation points out is that there is every reason to be joyous, because there's every reason to feel we can change the world. Because that is exactly what the gospel is about. The gospel is something forever young and forever hopeful. And with the succession of incredible popes that we have had, the church as well seems incredibly young again. The gospel is forever young and hopeful and committed because through us, Jesus Christ deigns to put things right. And to Jesus Christ has been given all rule, all authority in earth and in heaven. So in other words, we can change the world. And I think this really is the presupposition of Catholic social justice. And that is that things are not, as I said, cast in stone. Things are not given over to the power of the devil. Because where sin abounds, as St. Paul says, grace far more abounds. And in short, again to repeat myself, we can change the world. I want to begin proper with a very well-known New Testament passage. It's one I'm sure you've heard many times, and it's in all the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that is. And this is about the young ruler or the rich young ruler. As I say, I'm sure you've heard it very many times. And this is how it goes from Luke chapter 19. I'll skim it a bit. A ruler asked Jesus, "Good teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus said to him, "Why do you call me good? No one is good but God alone. You know the commandments. Do not commit adultery, do not kill, and so forth." And the young man said, "All of these laws I have observed since I was young." And when Jesus heard it, he said, "One thing you lack. Sell all that you have and distribute it to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and follow me." And when the young man heard this, he went away in despair because he was very rich. And Jesus said, "How hard it is for those who have riches to enter the kingdom of God." And the apostle said, "Who then can be saved?" Undoubtedly, as I say, you've heard this reading, I'm sure. Well, I hope you've heard this reading. I hope you've heard it many times before, and I don't want to bore you with pious platitudes. But what I want to do is point out what many commentators, I think, are blind to. The rich young ruler may well have thought that he had kept the law in all regards, that he had not committed adultery, murdered, stolen, and honored his parents. He may well have thought that he had kept all the law, but he certainly had not kept the law. And what we mean by the law is the Torah, something what we find in the first five books of the Bible. When Jesus said, "One thing you lack," what Jesus was saying, you do not and you are not keeping the law. You see, one of the points that is clear in the Gospels and in other literature of the time of Jesus, is that Judah and Jerusalem were full of poor and crippled people. You see that all the time in the Gospels. And as I say, in other of the literature of the time, that is also what we see. And that may well be for a number of reasons, not least because Jerusalem was a very rich city. It was actually the center of a lot of trade in terms of gold and jewelry. The point is that along with that, there were a lot of very poor and crippled people. Now, the law, the Torah, actually commands the rich to help the poor. This is in Leviticus chapter 25. And indeed, it actually commands people to lend without interest, that is, without usury. And in point of fact, if people cannot repay that money back, every 7 years, those debts are to be wiped out. In other words, it's a formula for an equitable redistribution of wealth in the Torah. For that young man to be ostentatiously rich, while many in Judah all around him were begging and crippled, quite clearly means he was not obeying God's law. But here's another aspect of it. Clearly the young man thought he was. But there's something even deeper here of an amazing blindness. There's another aspect to this event equally as telling, the reaction of the apostles, because the apostles say to Jesus, when Jesus says how difficult, how impossible it is for a rich man to get into heaven, the apostles say, well, how then can anyone be saved? What is implied in that comment is a blindness, even in the apostles, that they actually think that this man being wealthy, ostensibly keeping the law, must therefore be approved by God. And if that person isn't saved, then who can be saved? And of course, Jesus says, with men that's impossible, but with God all things are possible. But how is it possible for a rich man to be saved? And of course, the answer is, you help the poor. You help the poor. But what I want to focus on here is the blindness that is evident, not just in that young man, but also in the apostles. This blindness is important to identify because it is a blindness that works in structured in our very society. As a sister was just pointing out, how much of our consumer products, the cheap consumer products, how much of those are based upon sweatshops, slavery? How much of it is based upon that? How often do we get really bored by that? Oh, I switch off about it. But the simple point of the matter is we know, everyone really knows this, that a whole lot of our cheap stuff is based upon the exploitation of those in poorer countries. Quite plainly, that's the case. What is it that explains the ability for us to be blind? I think it's a doubleness, an ideological doubleness. And I want to come back to the chief example of that soon. But we might take the case of those asylum seekers and refugees. So many people think and know that it's right to support refugees, which it certainly and definitely is, and that the way in which we are treating them is nothing short than disgusting. And yet, those people who claim to speak up to refugees often are the very ones who say, Australia cannot afford any more people. We should have a limited population. One of the major reasons people oppose asylum seekers here is because they think, oh, we're overpopulated here. That country cannot bear it. In other words, we give a pious reason to our greed, our selfishness, and we play that game of doubleness, that blindness that allows us to do this. We are blind to our blindness. We are blind to our blindness, and that is how ideology always operates. One of the major ways in which ideology operates in order to keep things the same way, to keep the status quo in power, is to make people think you cannot change anything. This is the way it is. It's cast in stone. But again, this is as Pope Francis points out with evangelism, you can change. But to change things, we have to address that ideological blindness. And here I want to read another excerpt from the Gospel of Luke. This is coming up to the start of the Passion Week. Jesus has just come in with the apostles and disciples into Jerusalem. And as he comes up, as he comes closer and closer to the Passion, his language becomes more and more extreme. In hearing of all the people, he said to his disciples, this is in Luke chapter 20, verse 45, "Beware of the scribes who love to go about in long robes and love salutations in the marketplaces and the places of honor at the feasts, and yet who devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers. They will receive the greater condemnation." Jesus looked and saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury, and he saw a poor widow put in 2 copper coins. And he said, "Truly I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than all of them, for they contributed out of their abundance, and she out of her poverty." And some of the disciples spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with very noble stones and offerings. And they commented on it, and Jesus said to them, "As for these things, the days will come when there shall not be left one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." Again, there's something going on there that is easy not to see. First of all, Jesus's point about the very glorious, glamorous appearance of the scribes and Pharisees is there in order to cover up the devouring of widows' houses. How are widows' houses devoured? Through usury. Through a system such as we are under, insofar as everything is subject to market prices, to the investment. So in other ways, it's like payday loans that are very prevalent more and more in our culture, in which poorer people are given a loan to be repaid in a week, and if they don't, they have astronomical interest rates. So in the end, the poor people have to borrow more to pay back what they owe on the loans they already have. And in the end, what happens is their property is consumed by those loans. And that is usury, and that is what the law forbade. Jesus's point is, this is what is going on in the temple, and yet the law that the temple served forbade it. But there's something even deeper in this passage, something people do not see. When that widow was putting her money into the treasury, that treasury was actually the very place in which those religious authorities were getting the money to lend to widows in order at great interest rates in order to get their property. But that in itself is not what I want to point out here. There is a deeper blindness in the text that is what we are being told about. What is the apostles' and disciples' reactions? What are their reactions? Their reactions are not one of disgust at the religious authorities. They do not suddenly stand up and say, stop this, this is disgusting. They do not say to the poor widow putting her last lot of money in, don't do that, this is just corrupt. What do the disciples and apostles say? Wow, look at this amazing building. Look at these incredible stones. And Jesus' response to that is, you think this is really amazing stones to you? Well, not one stone will be left upon another. The anger of Jesus, I think, at the apostles and disciples, at their obtuseness there, at their blindness, I think is really, really telling. How is it that the apostles and disciples could be so blind when many of them have been with Jesus for, in some cases, 3 years? That is the power of an ideological blindness. Injustice gives rise to social forms of blindness. And one of the chief tasks of the prophets in the Old Testament was to make exactly clear what that culture wanted to keep hidden. You see, in point of fact, everyone really knows what is going on. We know of the exploitation of poor workers in Bangladesh, in Mexico, in Sri Lanka, in India, in China. We know that. But it's so much easier to pretend in a way that we do not know that. And that's a fact, too, of ideological blindness, that in fact, we all know that there is a silent compact that we have entered into wherein it is tacitly understood that you do not mention what is meant to be kept hidden. In the Old Testament, the Hebrew word for justice was mishpat. And that Hebrew word was again and again put in synonymous parallel. That means it's identified with the Hebrew word for righteousness. Justice and righteousness are of a piece. There is no separating them. And the core of justice in the Torah, taken up by Jesus, was the protection of the orphan, the widow, the poor, the stranger in the land. In other words, the most vulnerable, those who don't have money or wealth or power to protect themselves, they are the ones who are the ones specially reserved for the care of God. It's as the church says, following Jesus, we have a preferential option for the poor. But here's the thing that I want to really conclude upon. Why is it that our culture thinks that it's all right to treat refugees in the way we do? Why, in terms of prisons, why do we think it's right to put criminals in maximum security where effectively they are buried in a plastic capsule for years and years until they go mad? Because they're criminals? Why do we think it right to push for the euthanizing of the elderly and the sick? Why do we think it right to be party to the torture of those we delegate as being terrorists? Why do we do all these things and more when we live in a society of unprecedented wealth and comfort with plenty to share? But even stranger, we live in a culture that claims that every individual human life is valuable. And indeed, we live in a culture that is almost sentimental about the question of love. And yet again and again, our very economic prosperity is predicated upon the exploitation of poor workers in poorer countries. And that's not to mention the cargo ships and the exploitation of workers on cargo ships. There's a reason for this. It's doubleness. It's evil. It's sin and it's instructured. And it helps us to be blind to our blindness. But to see where this blindness really operates from is very easy to see if you look. And in the apostolic exhortation of the Holy Father of Pope Francis, he traces out the unjust economic structures that need to be challenged, notably free market ideology, and how evangelism must be allied to demanding justice for the poor the world over. And he concludes in that section in this way, I quote from Pope Francis, "Among the vulnerable for whom the church wishes to care with particular love and concern are unborn children, the most defenseless and innocent among us. Nowadays, efforts are made to deny them their human dignity and do with them whatever we will, taking their lives and passing laws preventing anyone standing in the way of this." That's Pope Francis. And in light of the recent laws enacted in Tasmania, it's incredibly pertinent. This is why we can treat refugees in the way we do, why we treat criminals in the way we do, why we are party to torture, why we can admire the rich and think them good citizens when they pay very little tax, why we do not hear Jesus or hear God's law, because at the heart of our culture is the fundamental injustice of abortion. There is a continuity of this crime. There's a continuity of the crime. That is where the doubleness of this ideology of global capital operates. As Catholics, we are to evangelize, but as Pope Francis observes, there can be no real lasting mission if there is no corresponding call to justice. And successive popes have given us the guidance to work for this, from the Second Vatican Council documents, Humanae Vitae, Gospel of Life, Charity and Truth, and now Pope Francis' Evangelii Gaudium. We have been given a very, very special privilege, an incredible blessing. For we have been called to be the voice for those who have no voice. We have been called to change the world, to speak up for refugees, exploited workers, and the unborn. But here's the thing. We have been given this special privilege, but you have to be warned to take it very, very seriously. Because as Jesus said, to whom much is given, much is expected. I've made a number of copies of this talk that's a bit fuller and with the references, and if you want a copy, I can give you one. But if there's any questions, I'll leave it open.
That was Dr. Robert Tilley with Opening Our Eyes to Injustice. The Faith in Action Expo was organised by the Sydney Archdiocesan Justice and Peace Office and was held at the University of Notre Dame, Australia in Sydney. And for more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.